We have the winds of our own totalitarian society freezing the land solid, a tortured tundra.
What we must have is a new American dream. We are allowed to ask any questions that we have. There are no wrong questions. A new American dream, not of homes and toasters, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. The new America, the real hope of the world.
Some of those who have spoken the truth are no longer here. Their chairs at the Thanksgiving adult big table are empty. Their relatives have sent them to Siberia with a roll of their eyes. So let us begin. Here we go. Scooch up to the samovar. Maybe leave your hat and boots on. Fill your peasant hands with a warm drink and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow. Try to remember the kind of September when grass was green and grain was yellow. Try to remember the kind of September when you were a tender and callow fellow. Try to remember, and if you remember, then follow. Try to remember when life was so tender that no one wept except the willow. Try to remember when life was so tender that dreams were kept beside your pillow. Try to remember when life was so tender that love was an ember about to billow. Try to remember, and if you remember, then follow. Deep in December, it's nice to remember, although you know the snow will follow. Deep in December, it's nice to remember, without a hurt, the heart is hollow. Deep in December, it's nice to remember, the fire of September that made us mellow. Deep in December, our hearts should remember and follow. And that seemed an appropriate song to start the month of September. It's hard to believe the year has progressed so far. Of course, lots of things are hard to believe. I'm often asked why I believe crazy, outlandish explanations for what's going on in the world. I'm asked if I really believe that our government crashed planes into buildings on 9/11/01. I'm asked if I really believe that Sandy Hook and Boston were false flag events. I'm asked if I really believe that the moon landings were some sort of staged Hollywood-style illusion. And I reply, I'm not sure. I'm rarely sure of anything. But I'm constantly looking at the evidence, and I'm trying to figure things out. And I am convinced of one thing, and that is that the U.S. government lies more than just about anybody else. I'm convinced they've been trying to sell us a bill of goods that does not match the events, that they've covered stuff up. And in many cases, they have been the instigators, the perpetrators of horrible crimes against humanity. But I'm still looking at the evidence, because I don't want to believe our leaders could be that evil. But for those that believe the government stories, I suggest they look harder at the evidence before making up their minds. I've been told I should be committed because of what I believe. But when somebody says that, I tell them their belief that the government is great is far more dangerous than my belief that it's corrupt. And then I ask for respect. And then I tell them that I really, really, really hope that they are right. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and I'm proud now to introduce you to my co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome special guests Sherwood Ross, Holy Damagard, and Nikki Z. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Coral Gables, somewhere in Spain, the People's Republic of Astoria, Queens, New York City, and wherever you are. Howling for Wolves. Stop Minnesota's wolf hunt by going to www.howlingforwolves.org. While you're at it, stop the Minnesota bear hunt, the Minnesota deer hunt, and stop logging away the forests. Okay, as always, in order to understand your world and also to appreciate the brave, awesome people who are on your side, listen to False Flag Weekly News with Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer. Read Veterans Today, Press TV, the Memory Hole blog of James Tracy, including the comments section. They're very good. Read Citizens for Legitimate Government with Lori Price and check out the Nuclear Resistor at nukeresistor.org. And we are presenting a truth book series, Save the World, Resist the American Empire. The first book, the dynamic duo, a biography of Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, is completed and available. And in process is a book showing that nobody died at Sandy Hook or Boston. This will come out for Christmas. Next will come a book in spring 2015 that will explore the questions of whether we went to the moon and whether the Holocaust happened as we are being told. Also, whether Paul McCartney, the real one, died a long time ago. The fourth book, cataloging and explaining the rash of U.S. false flag, false terror events in recent years. In this series entitled Save the World, Resist the American Empire, is scheduled for fall 2015, all produced by Chuck Gregory and CWG Press.
And now for another episode of The Lives of the Cowboys. From last week, stay clear, focused, fat and stupid. The colonel led his men in their morning mantra and then held out a box of red Twizzlers for Duke and Bubba Steve and the others to dig into on their way out the door. Hit the streets and be careful out there, boys. Information is everywhere, I'm afraid. But, hey, wait. The colonel stopped them to hand them the new updated face sheet from Homeland Security and Walmart on ISIS and how they're coming over here, and they'll probably be here soon, maybe late in the day, and this should be pretty much it, kind of a deal. So, said Hunt, holding the door for Duke, Bubba Steve, and the other officers. They stared at the open door in the street, and Mrs. Thomas, clutching her purse to her chest on her way to the post office. Go on, said the colonel, taking his boot and his knee to shove them all out the door. Get! So this week, we find Duke and Bubba Steve sitting in the squad car on the curb, staring straight ahead, eating popcorn. On homecoming parade duty, the crowd pushed up tight to the streets. The day was bright and blue. The bands marched past. The team floated past on a flatbed. And then, Bubba Steve grabbed for the radio mic and dropped it. His eyes were wide. Duke choked on his popcorn. It was happening. Coming straight down Main Street was a float. A big black float, the Deathmobile. Standing on the front of the float in a pirate bandana, pirate shirt, pirate pants, and pirate sword was John Belushi. He ripped off his shirt and displayed a white t-shirt with peach stains and ISIS written across the chest in pencil. "Ramming speed!" shouted Belushi, pointing his sword at Duke and Bubba Steve in the cruiser. Duke turned the key and pumped the gas. Bubba Steve tossed his popcorn out the window. The Deathmobile loomed large, closing in on them, headed straight for the cruiser. Isis, coming right at them at ramming speed, their worstest ever nightmare yet. Right out front of everybody. Duke and Bubba Steve's moms and dads and brothers, sisters, girlfriends, teachers. Isis, the cousin of Al and Bob Tatum, trying to take over the world, and they had to go through Duke and Bubba Steve to do it. Stay tuned next week for another episode of The Lives of the Cowboys, sponsored by Twizzlers, when we'll hear Duke say, "Allah Akbar," and we will hear Bubba Steve say, "I know, right?" The Lives of the Cowboys, sponsored by Twizzlers. Join tonight, sponsored by the Freshman Orientation Committee in the Student Center, Toga, 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 Fukushima, Hirohito's Revenge. Free popcorn and pop with your student ID. The 9/11 Museum was unveiled and opened this past spring in New York City, which begs the question, where will the Museum for Democracy be placed? It should be in Washington, D.C., we should think. Oh, yeah, you're right. Right next to the 9/11 Museum in New York City. I know, right? The Museum for Democracy will have a walkway from the 9/11 Museum and will have artifacts of September 11, 2001, such as the TV tapes and transcripts telling us not 10 minutes after it happened that it was done by Osama bin Laden. It will also be the missing video from the surrounding area showing the missile hitting the Pentagon. The Democracy Museum will also have artifacts from November 22, 1963, OKC, Waco, Wellstone, RFK, MLK, 9/11, Sandy Hook, Boston. The Democracy Museum will have the tape of Dan Rather telling us the Zapruder film shows Kennedy's head and body lurching forward. It will have the bullets found on the street next to J.D. Chippett's body, the second and third unexploded bombs found inside the Murrah building, the charred bodies of the children of Waco, the flight recorder of the Wellstone plane, the photos in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel, confiscated by the Los Angeles police, the real investigation into who are H-Wing Carver, Gene Rosen, and Robbie Parker, the real investigation into who really died or was injured at the Boston Marathon, and stuff like that.
The first guest of the night is Ole Domegaard. Ole comes to us each month from somewhere in Spain. I'm not sure of the city. Maybe Chuck knows, but maybe it's not important. But Ole has been a researcher into all of these conspiracies for many years. And earlier, either today or earlier this week, I'm not sure, Chuck conducted an interview with Ole, as he does each month, and we'll get to listen to that right now.
And now we welcome back to our show Ole Domegaard, our regular columnist, and he has something new for us today.
Well, thank you, Chuck. The thing is, maybe most of your listeners know that I've been studying assassinations, force strike operations globally for the last 30 years of my life, devoted myself deeply into the area, trying to expose what is really going on. And one of the things that I've discovered, not only that, I would say many of the so-called terror acts and assassinations on a high level are directly being carried out by the elite group or the elite few that is behind the so-called New World Order. That they use the same mechanics for decades. It's just been under new names for new operations and so on, and also there are many new generations of assassins and so on. But one of the things that I found out lately that I have not been aware of is that many of the high, high key serial killers as well had been used by the same group. And I would almost suggest that they have been created by the same group. We're talking deeply involved in the MKUltra military industrial complex, whatever that includes, and the CIA working together. When you look into the history behind many of the major so-called serial killers, you will find a very similar story, that they have a very troubled childhood with lots of sexual abuse from families connected to the military, military stations, the CIA. It's the same story being repeated. And then once you start looking into the spree of killings that they're accused of done, it's almost like a big portion of these killings are actual ordered hits on competitors in the drug business or people they want to get rid of. And then that has been concealed with a lot of other killings so that you won't see a clear pattern of these being executions. And they, if you look also the way that they, the method many of these people use, it's very often following the exact template that the CIA has for in their manual for assassins. And one of their favorites is the headshot with a 22 caliber. The reason why they want a small caliber is that the projectile enters the skull. They always go for headshots. And then since it's not powerful enough to exit, it will just start ricocheting inside the skull and cause maximum damage. Whereas if you use a very powerful handgun, you will just get a hole right through the skull, and many times the victim will survive, or the chances of survival is a lot bigger. They also use weapons that can be found at the time of the assassination. Any heavy object or screwdriver, knives that can be found on location, which is highly recommended by the CIA, because then there's no chance of you having been caught on the way to the crime scene with a weapon on you, and also you leave without it. The scary thing I would say is that many times when you see these serial killers being caught, they have like this invisible protection from above. You will see that they go into court and suddenly either they're sentenced without having any chance of a defense. The lawyer, the defense lawyer, seems to be on the being part of the whole accusation, and that the trial is just a big joke. Or you will see that they have, like I said, like an invisible protection from above. They're sentenced, but then they're released very, very quickly, or only after a few years. And some of them, even after having, admitted to like several hundred killings, have been pardoned and so on. And one of the states where this happens is in Texas, or where it used to happen was in Texas, where George Bush Jr. was the governor. And he was well known for not pardoning anyone, except the very few ones that he ever pardoned were serial killers with hundreds of admitted killings. So go figure. And, sorry?
Well, that's, this is a fascinating analysis, and basically you've taken off on a new tack. But before, I'd like to hear some, one or two specific examples if you have them. But before we do that, often we don't get to tell our listeners about your website, and I'd like to take this opportunity to do that right now.
That's very kind of you, Chuck. My website is lightonconspiracies.com, lightonconspiracies.com. And my book is Coup d'etat in slow motion. Oh, that's one of them. I've written several. But that is about the assassination of the Swedish prime minister. But that is just one of the assassinations in a whole long row of execution-style hits in combination with illegal arms trading globally. very much connected to the Iran-Contra, very much even connected to the JFK assassination. People in the team that was in Dallas was actually on site 23 years later, taking out the Swedish prime minister. And the same team of assassins that has also been involved in the Robert Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, the overtake of the Salvador Allende in Chile, 1973, on 9/11 actually, the killing of Pablo Neruda, the poet, the Nobel Prize winning poet, Robert Smith in South Africa, Uwe Barcher in West Germany, Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C., and many, many others. They've been very active over the decades. And the paymaster for this group that has been active since the late 50s were George Bush Sr. And he has used this group during his whole career. They just changed formation and names for different operations, but the key players have been very, very central in the whole thing. One of them being Porter Gough, who was later the head of the CIA for a little while. So high-level players, high level.
Well, I would
also say that if people would like to support me, I've put 30 years of deep research into this. I have people, friends, murdered around me. I have to leave my country and so on. So I'm really doing what I can to expose this. And one way of supporting it is buy my book or sign up for my newsletter or donations. It's very, very appreciated for me to be able to continue.
Well, absolutely. And I urge our listeners to hear that and go visit lightonconspiracies.com and buy the book. But Olay, getting back to the serial killers, do you have an example of one or two who
You got like Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole and people like that, very high profile serial killers. One other thing as well, I would say, it's like I think we're being tricked a bit here around the serial killers because they hardly existed before the 1950s or late 50s, early 60s, exactly like the time when this cabal took over with the killing of the JFK. At least there were examples, but it's just exploded ever since then. And when you look into it, these killers have been extremely connected to the military-industrial complex in the form of military installations, Navy bases, and so on, and also CIA, MKUltra. But it also goes, unfortunately, very deep into this whole satanic, awful thing with pedophiles, trafficking and awful things done to children and so on. But it goes globally. This is the scary thing. And this is why things like in England now, when the English Queen and the former Pope have been charged with child genocide, this is just one little part that is cracking up in this international network. And I think we're going to see a lot more of it coming forward. It's coming in Belgium, Sweden, many other countries. It's coming up to the surface more and more.
Well, that's it's good that it's coming to the surface, but it's pretty awful that's been happening.
It makes me optimistic because the more I look into so many of these atrocities when it comes to wars, assassinations, terror acts, pedophile gang, drug trafficking on the highest level, gun, arm stealing on the highest level. I come back to the same group again and again and again and again. So it's like unreal many times. I just feel this is just like mind-blowing. But at the same time, we're talking about an elite few. They call themselves the elite. I call them the minority because they're only like 5,000-6,000 in total. And the truth is that we are 7 billion, so the whole idea of them controlling us and accomplishing so much pain to the rest of the world, it's just unreal. It's really high time for us, the rest of us, to wake up and expose this group so it will stop, you know, because just by exposing them, neutralizing them, this whole world would take the step upwards in a beautiful way of its own, I tell you, because they have inflicted so much pain over the years.
Well, I'm completely 100% behind you on making positive changes for the world and getting this information out to people. I think we're about out of time, but I really look forward to talking with you each month and hope to hear more about this next time. In the meantime, once again, that's lightonconspiracies.com and Ole Domingo. Thank you and good night.
Thank you, Chuck. You had a good one.
I'll tell you, Ole always has a new wrinkle. This thing with the serial killers being caused by the same people is just a fascinating idea.
I've never heard that before, Chuck. I've never heard it before. You know, I guess I'd have to read more of what Ole's got to say. Maybe he has more of that on his website. I might, maybe I probably will take a look at that.
Yes, I think he has some of that on his website, and he'll be putting some more up because this apparently is something that he just kind of stumbled across as he was investigating other things.
What's that book? What's the book of his again? I know it's Light on Conspiracies, and but his most recent book is called
Coup d'État in Slow Motion.
And that what it that's. Let me just guess. I haven't read it. It must be about a history of all these false flags in slow motion.
It's primarily about the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme.
I see.
His assassination, but it links in many of the others.
I see. Okay.
And now, a public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Walmart, and Martha Stewart. We are now on triple secret orange alert. Pull the apple pie from the windowsill, secure the baseball field, the Chevrolets, secure Grandma. Bubba Keita and Bubba Sis have been spotted in the U.S. They're born in a small town, in little pink houses, getting their thrills on Blueberry Hill, getting their kicks on Route 66. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Now pull up close some flannel and some pie and a Lutheran. It's again time for your Lake Wobegon American Dream nap time story. America is Nazi Germany and worse because we don't yet know it is and we have not yet hit bottom. But we persist in sleepwalking the American dream all the same. As George Carlin said, you have to be asleep to believe it. The lawns are still looking green. Garrison Keillor began his soporific monologue last Saturday, talking about the start of school, the end of summer, Lake Wobegon, and Pastor Inkfist, and Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility, the hopeful gospel singers. And why not? Why not lose oneself in fantasy in order to live one more happy day in America? Holding the door tight against reality with one hand while cutting the Thanksgiving turkey with the other. But we can't help but ask why. Why don't those with influence use that influence to tell us about what it is, what is real? Sure, they can do what they want with their cachet. Keillor has this immense talent and great idea and longevity. He can do what he wants, and he will, well, of course. As well as the movie producers, technicians, musicians, artists, novelists, screenwriters, they put in the long hours for decades and just barely make it. And then when they do, why should they throw it away?
for heaven's sake. This has been your Lake Wobegon American Dream Naptime Story, sponsored by Jack's Auto Repair, Ralph's Pretty Good Grocery, Bertha's Kitty Boutique, also by the Sidetrack Tap, Bunsen Motors, Krebs Box Chevrolet, and Powder Milk Biscuits. Heavens, they're tasty and expeditious.
And now for another episode of The Lives of the Cowboys. We see John Belushi and the ISIS Deathmobile headed straight for Duke and Bubba Steve on the curb on Main Street in the cruiser in the middle of a homecoming parade. They leap out just as the Deathmobile smashes the front quarter panel. They land in the street and on the sidewalk as the car explodes. John Belushi, the ISIS leader, leaps above the flames, climbs the fire escape to the top of the Woolworths building. There he looks down up on the whole town, swooping his sword around. Bubba Steve sits on the sidewalk watching. Duke sits in the street looking straight up at ISIS Belushi, who's taken over the town. Dude, Allah effing Akbar, says Bubba Steve, ripping a pack of red Twizzlers with his teeth. I know, right, says Duke? The Lives of the Cowboys, hunted by Twizzlers in a bright red plastic.
And now a letter to the editor from Tracy in Boca Raton. Go FAU Owls, almost beat the Cornhuskers, not. This week we will roll the tide, or not. Well, in the wake of World War I, erstwhile propagandist and political scientist Harold Lasswell famously defined propaganda as the management of collective attitudes and the control over opinion through the manipulation of significant symbols. The extent to which this tradition is enthusiastically upheld in the West and the United States in particular is remarkable. The American public is consistently propagandized by its government and corporate news media on the most vital of contemporary issues and events. Deception on such a scale would be of little consequence if the U.S. was not the most powerful economic and military force on earth. A case in point is the hysteria Western news media are attempting to create concerning the threat posed by the mercenary terrorist army now being promoted as the Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, or ISIS. As was the case with U.S. intelligence asset and bogey publicized as Al-Qaeda, such entities are, apparently by design, inadequately investigated and defined by major news media. Absent meaningful historical context, they usefully serve as another reason for America's terminal war on terror. A seemingly obvious feature of such terrorist forces left unexamined by corporate media is that they are observably comprised of the same or comparable personnel unleashed elsewhere throughout the Middle East as part of a strategy proposed during the George W. Bush administration in 2007. With the above observations in mind, ISIS is well-financed, militarily proficient, and equipped with modern vehicles and weaponry. It also exhibits an uncanny degree of media savvy in terms of propagating its message in professional-looking videos and on platforms such as YouTube and Twitter. Western Intelligence Services, the New York Times reports, claim to be worried about their extraordinary command of seemingly less lethal weapons, state-of-the-art videos, ground images shot from drones, and multilingual Twitter messages. As coverage of the events of September 11, 2001, and subsequent state-sponsored terrorism indicates, such media are essentially a component of the national security state. Their reports and broadcast scripts are all but overtly written by intelligence and military organizations. In the wake of 9/11, U.S. news media seldom asked about the origins of Al-Qaeda, particularly how it was a product of U.S. intelligence agencies. With the history of Al-Qaeda omitted, the Bush administration was permitted to wage war on Afghanistan almost immediately followed following those staged attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, yet has as much the case with today's manufactured ISIS phenomenon that history was readily available and its careful public examination might have implicated the United States intelligence community in the 9/11 attacks. As the U.S. and world approach the 13th anniversary of the most momentous false flag in modern history, the American public would be well served to remind itself that ISIS is the new Al-Qaeda. In other words, the new pretext that will in all likelihood be used but to take police state measures at home and military aggression abroad to new, perhaps unprecedented levels. With the above in mind, it is telling that one of the U.S. government's greatest fears isn't ISIS at all. The FBI's most recent threat assessment for domestic terrorism makes no reference to Islamic terror threats, the Washington Free Beacon reports, despite last year's Boston Marathon bombing and the 2009 Fort Hood shooting, both carried out by radical Muslim Americans. Instead, the nation's foremost law enforcement agency is preoccupied with what it deems domestic extremism exhibited by its own subjects. A primary manifestation of such extremism is possessing the curiosity to discern and seek out truth and information amidst the barrage of manipulated symbols the government and corporate-controlled media use to undermine a potentially informed public. The second guest of the evening is Sherwood Ross, and we are a few minutes early, but Chuck will attempt to get Sherwood on the line anyway, and maybe we can give Sherwood a few extra minutes. Sherwood Ross is a veteran news reporter. He started in Chicago, as we've said before, and he was with the civil rights movement. He was with them, literally, in Memphis, and he knew Martin Luther King, and he has extensive experience in giving us real reporting from a real reporter.
Hey there.
Well, hello, Sherwood. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
How are you doing, Chuck?
I'm doing real well, Sherwood. How are you?
I'm fine. I've got this story called Imperial Fairy Tales.
Well, that sounds good. Stay on the line after you get done, because I think we have a little bit of extra time tonight.
Great. You know, over the years, I've heard it said the Japanese were guilty after World War II of using textbooks that did not tell the true story of their atrocities in that conflict. Critics said their books did not mention, for example, the rape of Nanking and white crimes. Well, since I don't read Japanese and have never seen a Japanese text, I can't tell you if the critics are right or wrong, but based on what I know of current events, notably watching the disaster unfold at Fukushima, where the nuclear plant melted down, I suspect the Japanese are perfectly capable of covering up their mistakes and crimes. Today, Japanese authorities are withholding the facts on the true scope of the calamity, which will continue spreading radioactive fire for hundreds of years, for centuries, maybe thousands of years, and literally threaten life on this planet. However, I do speak English, and I found one of my granddaughter's textbooks the other day lying around, and I thought I would check it out to see what it says about any war crimes perpetrated by Imperial America. The book is titled United States History, Preparing for the Advanced Placement Examination. The authors, John Newman and John Schmalbach, published by AMSCO School Publications of New York City. It's a fact the U.S. seized the Philippines from Spain in 1898 as an outcome of the Spanish-American War. The text rightly says, quote, "The people of the Philippines were outraged that their hopes for national independence from Spain were now being denied by the United States." Filipino nationalist leader Emilio Aguinaldo had fought alongside U.S. troops during the Spanish-American War. Now he led bands of guerrilla fighters in a war against U.S. control. It took U.S. troops 3 years and cost thousands of lives on both sides before the insurrection finally ended in 1902. And that's it. No mention of the 200,000 Filipino civilians killed from disease and deprivation caused by the American-made war. No mention of the thousands of captured Filipino soldiers tortured to death by the Americans. To add insult to injury, the AMSCO book refers to the Filipinos who resisted American rule as guerrillas, you know, some kind of primitive jungle creatures, but not patriots, defending their country from foreign aggression. Less than a half a century later, President Truman ordered dropping atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Of this stupefying atrocity, all that the AMSCO text has got to say is this, quote, "About 250,000 Japanese died, either immediately or after a prolonged period of suffering as a result of the two bombs," end quote. And that's it. No moral judgments. However, when it came to Hitler's extermination of European Jewry during World War II, the AMSCO book had this to say. As U.S. troops advanced through Germany, they came upon German concentration camps and witnessed the horrifying extent of the Nazis' program of genocide against the Jews and others. Americans in the world were shocked to learn that as many as 6 million Jewish civilians had been systematically murdered by Nazi Germany. Yes, what Hitler did was horrifying and shocking, rightly, but not the murder of 250,000 innocent Japanese civilians by Harry Truman and the United States Army Air Corps. It seems to me that all nations, not just Japan, cover up their crimes and atrocities in their texts, while they denounce the lies and cover-ups of other nations. Notice how President Obama condemns the execution of innocent American journalists in the Middle East, but carries out deadly airstrikes against his own alleged enemies in the Middle East, all of whom must be presumed innocent, as none of them have had a fair trial by jury. How much difference is there between the two policies? As for press coverage, reporters throughout history have shown a lamentable tendency to toe the official government line. The Japanese press ran wild during World War II. It glorified two Japanese officers who had a contest at Nanking, China, to see which of them could behead 100 Chinese civilians the fastest, and they did. In World War II, Edward R. Murrow created sympathy among Americans for the British by standing on the rooftops of London in reporting about how the German civilians, how the German warplanes were blitzing the cities, killing civilians. Later in the war, he flew on American warplanes that bombed German cities, killing civilians. And if he spoke any words of concern for innocent German civilians being wiped out, I haven't read them. 8,000 German civilians died. You know, I think we need an international historians exchange. American historians ought to go to Japan and teach Japanese school children about their leaders' crimes and vice versa. And maybe teach President Obama it's wrong to kill innocent civilians, such as those dying in the drone attacks. Otherwise, civilian populations may well be lulled to sleep by imperial fairy tales spawned by their governments hell-bent on conquest. I'm Sherwood Ross. Good night to every one of you.
Sherwood, that was a fantastic piece.
Thank you, Chuck.
You know, history just always seems to be written by the people that win.
Yes. Yes, and there's victor's justice, that those executed after a war frequently are innocent, but they were on the losing side. And the Japanese general Yamashita is an example of that. He was known as the Tiger of Malaya, and he conquered Malaya from the British in World War II. And when the Americans were looking for a scapegoat for somebody who raped Manila in the Philippines in 1945, they dragged out General Yamashita, even though he wasn't in the Philippines at the time. In fact, it was not his troops who were regular army, but it was Japanese Imperial Marines who raped the city toward the end of the war. It was a great tragedy, and Yamashita was hung for a crime he didn't commit.
Well, you know, I've never seen or read about a war where anybody on either side was really innocent.
No, they're all innocent. You know, I watch the Budweiser commercials, and they celebrate an American soldier returning from the Middle East. And, of course, they're all putting down a Bud. But nothing is said about whether it's right or wrong to fight for a dictatorship, which is what the United States of America sadly has become.
Sherwood, where were you during World War II?
I was sitting at the kitchen table in Chicago, Illinois, on December 7th, 1941. We were having our lunch when the news came over that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. And my father, who followed international events closely, said, "This means war," immediately. And of course, he was right.
I think by the time that happened, there was very little question that it would mean war. Certainly, there seems to be a lot of evidence that it was set up, that we invited the attack or created the attack in order to get into the war.
Well, I'm someone who disagrees with that theory. Franklin Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy in World War I. He was a yachtsman. He loved ships. He loved the Navy. I don't think that he would have allowed Pearl Harbor to be surprised if he had known about it. A lot of people are arguing now that he did know, but I don't think so. And sometimes when you get bulletins, you don't necessarily read them the minute they come in, such as the Japanese fleet was seen steaming toward Hawaii. I don't think it was a setup at all. Ammunition lockers were locked with the ammunition inside. All the Japanese had to do was attack Pearl Harbor with one plane and the United States would have declared war. Why would the United States allow this full-scale attack to go unchecked by their own forces? It wasn't necessary.
Well, I'm interested and rather glad to hear you say that, because I'd certainly rather believe that.
Yeah. President Roosevelt, as far as I can tell, was not a monster. And his attention to domestic details, such as ending the Depression, Social Security, and all those New Deal programs, showed that his concern was for suffering people, just as he was suffering from paralysis. His concern was not on aggrandizing the United States globally. That would come later. And there was a lot of anti-war sentiment in America back in the 30s and 40s.
Well, there's our signal, and I'm going to have to say goodbye, but this was a very interesting segment, and thank you for being on the show, Sherwood.
Thank you, Chuck. Good night to every one of you.
And now, for a review of today's news. From Citizens for Legitimate Government. Former CIA contractor Stephen Kelly says that the ISIL terrorist group is a completely fabricated enemy created and funded by the United States. Is a completely fabricated enemy, he said in a phone interview with Press TV from Anaheim, California on Thursday. The funding is completely from the United States and its allies. And for people to think that this enemy is something that needs to be attacked in Syria or Iraq is a farce, because obviously this is something that we create, that we control. Only now it has become inconvenient for us to attack this group as a legitimate enemy, Kelly added. The Pentagon has already launched at least 100 airstrikes on ISIL positions in northern Iraq since Obama authorized the use of force against the terrorist group earlier this month. If you want to get to the root of the problem and remove this organization, the first thing they need to do is remove the funding and take care of entities responsible for the creation of this group, Kelly said. '9/11 Film Festival, Oakland Grand Lake Theater, September 8, 2013. It's the 9th annual 9/11 Film Festival, Wednesday, September 11th, 1 to 11 p.m. at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California. This year's theme, 50 years of betrayal from JFK to today. Many short films on 9/11 and the assassinations of the 60s will be screened. New feature-length films include Bill Still's Jekyll Island, The Truth Behind the Federal Reserve, Project Censored, the movie, NATO's Secret Army, Gladio, and the evening feature, 9/11 in the Academic Community. New this year, if you can't make the show, you can live stream it below. The webpass ticket is $5, and it's good to see the archives after the event until September 30th. Let's see here. From the nuclear resistor, three men arrested protesting dedication of New Kansas City nuclear weapons parts plant. 4 years after a series of civil resistance arrests and jailings began to protest groundbreaking for the destruction of the United States' first entirely new nuclear weapons factory in decades, three people were arrested on August 22nd while speaking out against the official dedication of the new Kansas City plant. The new benign-sounding national security campus will help develop and fabricate unique non-nuclear components for a new generation of U.S. nuclear weapons intended to threaten humanity through the end of the century. While politicos and war industrialists assembled to bless the massive, tastefully landscaped industrial facilities, Peaceworks KC and Physicians for Social Responsibility KC sponsored a mock dedication funeral. 55 people joined in, planting sunflower seeds, carrying a faux coffin and signs down the long sidewalk, past manicured lawns, and past a new pond, under the watchful eye of security guards for Honeywell, the prime contractor. Jim Hanna, Henry Staver, and Mark Bartholomew stepped across the property line at the entry to the facility's long driveway. When they refused to leave, they were arrested. Kansas City police took the men into custody. Hanna and Stever were released on bond a few hours later, while Bartholomew was jailed for about 20 hours. This from Henry Stever, opening welcome. I bow to all of you truth seekers who know the true end result of these weapons of mass destruction, constructed, procured, and assembled here, which is death. I honor all of you realists who are able to know the end reality and the use of these products here is genocide, war crime, and irreparable harm to all inhabitants. I am thankful to all of you prophets, not prophits, but prophets who of old gave us the choice to choose life or choose death. I bow to all of you who refuse to be silent in the face of an evil greater than the Holocaust. I am grateful to all of you concerned about the fate of this earth, for we must take action, give witness, and give hope to our children and grandchildren, so that we have not lived in vain. I thank all of you who choose to stand on the side of love, for war is never the end. Violence and destruction have begotten more of the same. I bow to all of you who care for and act for the least of our brothers and sisters, for we know that President Eisenhower's words, that all of these armaments are a theft from those who are in greatest need, is truth. I bow to all of you who feel compelled by faith, by hope, by morality, by ethics, by ecology, to say that we must reverse and abolish these weapons of mass destruction. Today, this is a solemn occasion, a totally non-violent, peaceful occasion, one conducted in utter sincerity and love. We witness in peace and love. Henry M. Stevens. For information about additional August 6th protests at Livermore Labs, Vandenberg Air Force Base, the Pentagon, Bangor, Washington, and Lockheed Martin, go to the Nuclear Register at nukeregister.org.
Our third guest of the night is Mickey Z. Mickey Zezima is a writer, activist, and personal trainer in Astoria, Queens, New York City. He has, if you want to go to Mickey Z, see his writings at mickeyzvegan.wordpress. Or you can just Google Mickey Z and you'll see a lot of his writings.
And now we welcome once again Mickey Z, the New York activist, writer, artist, photographer, Jack Baltic.
Yes.
Come on.
Hey, great to be here as always.
So, before the interview, we were talking a little bit about the Great March for Climate Action, and it sounded as though you had some new thoughts about that.
Yeah, it's been the time since we last spoke, as it gets getting closer to this big march, more and more information has been coming out. And if you go to the website, you here in New York City, I'm talking about, you'll see that they openly talk about how they negotiated for, they say, months with the NYPD, police department here, to pick the right route. And a little context. We have parades in New York City all the time, you know, famous ones like the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade and the St. Patrick's Day Parade, but they go on almost every Sunday, and there is this standard route that goes down Fifth Avenue. So there is a parade route set up every Sunday. This particular parade coming up, I'm calling it a parade facetiously, for the Climate March, is on a Sunday, yet somehow, it's set to coincide with a huge climate summit taking place at the UN. Now, the UN is as far east on Manhattan Island as you can get. It's right on the East River. Somehow, the Climate March organizers have agreed to a route that begins at Columbus Circle, which is in Midtown, and then winds its way down 42nd Street west to 11th Avenue, which would be at 34th Street, which would virtually be the exact opposite side of the island as the United Nations, and lets you off in a virtual no man's land. The only thing down there is the Javits Center, which is a big convention center. But it's an area of Manhattan where very rarely do you see anybody do activism unless it's specific to that geographical area, because there's not street traffic, you don't have foot traffic, you don't have people that you can do outreach. So I was quite disappointed to see that this march has turned into sort of a permitted parade that, outside of a small period near Times Square, doesn't really go through any major area of New York City, is guided as far away as possible from the UN by the NYPD, has no speakers, has no unifying vision. And if you look at the website of the endorsers, they range from the obscure to corporations that are responsible for climate change and so on. So I definitely have shifted in terms of my anticipation for the September 21st March here, because it seems like it's just designed to have maybe 100,000 people scream and yell and hold puppets and chant, but really not really, really designed, you know, by the organizers and by the city government to not disrupt anything and not really have any outcome at all, essentially. So I can't speak. I'm sure there are New York City activists who will break off from this march. And I know that there's other stuff planned the next day, that Monday morning, on Wall Street. But in general, it's disappointing that the whole nation was looking at what New York was going to do on Sunday, September 21st, and New York basically caved. I mean, the organizers basically took the route that the NYPD wanted, and it doesn't seem like an event like this could be designed to do anything more than make people feel good that they took part in a march.
Hmm. Well, that really is disappointing. Now, you know, the part of it that that I've been talking to a guy that's on the Great Climate March as opposed to the People's Climate March.
Okay.
The Great Climate March is this one where they started in L.A. And they've been marching since, I think, March 1st.
Okay.
Okay. And they're supposed to be arriving in New York City somewhere around the 20th or 21st and joining up with this People's Climate March for what I thought was going to be a big event, but it sounds as though it's not at all what I thought.
Well, it will be a big event, but that depends on how one, in terms of sheer size, as somebody that takes part in a lot of activism in New York City, there's often times that you create a demonstration or a protest and you don't, and you draw 20, 30 people holding signs and chanting and so on. So the possibility that anywhere from 100 to 200,000 people will be marching or watching the parade makes it a big event in the way that any parade in New York City would be a big event. It requires permits and barricades and street closings and diverting of traffic. So don't get me wrong. There will be people who will be cursing that day saying, wow, I can't even get anywhere in the city. Subway stations are closed down. I'm sure the NYPD will be out in full force. But in terms of it being something like, imagine if it just, instead of turning west towards the Hudson River, it turned east towards the UN, and there is a park across the street from the UN where there would be enough space for not 200,000 people, but for a fair amount of people, that if they had a stage and they had a diverse group of speakers talking about different aspects of addressing climate change and calling out those who are responsible for it, it certainly would be more productive than to march west away from where the summit is with no speakers and endorsers and groups that basically anyone who wants can take part in it. And I'll give you a quick anecdote on that. A big issue in New York City, it has been since Bill de Blasio got elected mayor. He said he was going to end the carriage horse industry. So the animal rights movement in New York City is happy and trying to end this abusive to horses industry. And de Blasio has kind of just, you know, backed off and not really done anything about it. But the group that the unions and so on that protect the industry are very, very clever and very good with public relations. So they're openly preparing to march in the People's Climate March because one of the proposals to replace the horses being pulling carts through Central Park would be electric cars that look like classic cars. So they're latching onto that. The batteries of the electric cars are toxic and they go into landfill. So they found their angle in there. So even though the number one cause of human-created greenhouse gases is global animal byproducts industry, this small group of people that are responsible for exploiting animals found their way into the People's Climate March. So I'm not saying that people should be restricted from it, but unless there's some kind of guiding vision towards a big event like that, it just becomes so amorphous that it's just basically, you know, ExxonMobil could march and say, well, you know, we support the addressing of climate change, because those words don't have any meanings without actions behind them. And that's what it kind of feels like.
Well, that's pretty depressing.
I'm curious to hear more about this Great Climate March, because that sounds like the kind of grassroots community effort. If you're marching across the country, you're interacting with people where they live, not randomly on an asphalt street in Manhattan where they got on the subway and came to watch the march. If you're marching through communities and affected communities that have to deal with fracking and the tar sands pipeline and mountaintop mining, if you're walking, you know, communities that have had trees clear cut to make grazing space for cattle or have runoff from factory farms polluting their rivers and lakes, walking through those communities with a message of we need to work together to address climate change seems to me to be the type of action that I can get totally behind, as opposed to a one-day spectacle of people wearing costumes and singing songs and kind of just, and then obeying the police saying, you know, where are we allowed to march and going through and being guided, like I said, away from the UN. So, yeah, the great climate march sounds like a old school grassroots community-based effort that the kind of thing that we need to get back to, get off social media sometime and get back out into the communities.
I think that's exactly right. I'd really like to see more of that kind of thing. I mean, what a commitment it is to go out and march from March 1st till November 1st.
Yeah.
15 miles a day. I mean,
I am so impressed with that. And when people, when you hold a Sunday afternoon march in Manhattan, a lot of things are closed. People tend to be off, even though this is an economy where people are working more than one job and working many hours. But many people tend to be off on a Sunday. So it's not exactly a sacrifice to say, I'm going to get on the subway Sunday morning, ride to Columbus Circle in Manhattan, and join, hold a sign, and sing songs and march through, and when we reach 11th Avenue, I'll say goodbye, walk back to the subway, and go home. And I'm not disparaging that, but it hardly represents sacrifice. And but when you, like you said, when somebody says, I'm going to march 15 miles a day over the next 8 months or so, and interact directly in communities, maybe camp out, or some communities might put some of the marchers up for them, you have real conversations around a dinner table or in a living room, and when you're asking people to understand that we all have to make huge sacrifices in the name of saving our ecosystem, what better way to do that than you, as someone who is making a huge sacrifice in their own life? And, of course, not everyone has the privilege of the ability to march for 8 months because they have obligations and responsibilities. But those who've done that are standing up for so many of us. And as I said, in the months since you and I last spoke, I have just gained more and more respect for the Great Climate March and less enthusiasm for this spectacle that this Sunday afternoon parade that's going to take place a couple of weeks from now in New York City.
Well, yeah, I agree. I'll keep following this, I've been following this Great Climate March, which their website is climatemarch.org, and it's really an impressive thing. They have involved people along the way. They have people come up, talk to them, march with them. Donate to help keep them going, and I think they've really involved a lot of people. So yeah, I hope we can see some more of that.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm going to start promoting that website and following it just like you are, because this is exactly the type of start that we need. I mean, we obviously need a lot more than that, but the way to connect with those who are affected by climate change in the communities that are typically underprivileged and oppressed and marginalized, and a chance to interact with these individuals is huge. And that's the message I'm going to send. And I'm actually doing a talk on the 18th in Astoria, which is part of Queens of New York City, where I live. And the theme of the talk will be environmentalism and so on, and it's time to be before this big march. And I was already planning to talk about a lot of the stuff you and I just spoke about, but I think I'm going to really, bone up on this Great Climate March and learn more about it. And so I can hold that up as an example of what other people are doing and other ways to address this ecocide that at the end of the day whatever your personal issue is and whatever lights you up in terms of activism and in life, everything becomes, all those points become moot if we don't have a functioning ecosystem.
Well, that's the end of our time. I really enjoyed talking to Nick.
And now some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph.
From Christopher in Green Hedges. The climate change march in New York on September 21, expected to draw as many as 200,000 people. It's one of the last gasps of conventional liberalism to respond to the climate crisis. Will take place 2 days before the actual gathering of world leaders in New York, called by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, to discuss the November 2015 UN Climate Conference in Paris. The marchers will dutifully follow the route laid down by the New York City Police. They will leave Columbus Circle on West 59th Street and 8th Avenue at 11:30 a.m. on a Sunday, conclude on 11th Avenue between West 34th and 38th Street. No one will reach the United Nations, which is located on the other side of Manhattan, on the East River beyond First Avenue. At least legally. There will be no speeches. There's no list of demands. It will be a climate-themed street fair. March, because its demands are amorphous, can be joined by anyone. This is intentional. But as activist Ann Peterman has pointed out, this also means some of the groups backing the march are little more than corporate funds. The climate group, for example, which endorses the march, includes among its members and sponsors BP, China Mobile, Dow Chemical Company, Duke Energy, HSBC, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, and Greenstone. The Environmental Defense Fund, which says it works with companies rather than against them, which is calling on its members to join the march, has funding from the oil and gas industry and supports fracking as a form of alternative energy. These fallen environmental organizations are designed to neutralize resistance, and their presence exposes the march's failure to adopt a meaningful agenda or pose a genuine threat to power. Our only hope comes from radical groups descending on New York to carry out direct action, including global climate convergence and popular resistance. March, if you want, but it should be the warm-up. The real fight will come once people disperse on 11th Avenue. The march is symbolic, says Kevin Lees, the popular resistance, when I read the FICO. But we're past the term of symbolism. What we need is direct action against the United Nations during the meeting. This should include blockades and disruption of the meeting itself. We need to highlight the fact that the United Nations has sold out to corporate interests. At UN meetings on climate change, you see corporate logos on display. During the last meeting on climate change in Poland, the UN held a simultaneous conference to promote coal as a clean energy source. These UN meetings have become corporate trade shows where discussions on climate are hijacked to promote corporate interests. Barack Obama has announced he will continue the U.S. stance of only calling for voluntary climate goals in advance of the upcoming climate summit in Paris next year. The fossil fuel industry and corporations from ExxonMobil to Coca-Cola industry underwrite political campaigns and author our legislation. They've stacked the courts with their judges and the airwaves with their apologists. They fund our scientific research and have effectively silenced dissidents. This corporate reach extends to the United Nations. Companies set up exhibition halls at UN climate summits, promoting various corporate schemes to profit from the climate crisis, from clean coal and biofuel to nuclear power and carbon trading. Those who attempt to offer a counter-narrative, especially after the disruption with the climate summit in Copenhagen in 2009, are swiftly silenced by UN security. Fences and security barriers now ring heavily guarded UN climate conferences. Protesters are herded into police-controlled free speech zones outside, like the march in New York, and ruthlessly dealt with if they deviate from the approved routes or make their voices heard among the delegates. The UN Security and Climate Summits, which includes physically removing journalists so they cannot photograph or document protests that are shut down by courts, is so absolute that the UN demands pre-approved wording for T-shirts worn in its gathering. The elites, whether in Congress or attending UN summits, have no intention of cutting off their access to wealth, power, and privilege. They know where the money is. They know what they have to do to get it. And we are not part of the equation. Our democracy is an elaborate public relations charade. And the longer we accept this charade, the longer we will be irrelevant. Only when we understand power can we fight it. This fight must be waged on two fronts. We must disrupt the machinery of corporate capitalism and at the same time build parallel, autonomous structures for self-governance that address basic needs such as food and green energy. This is not a battle I would have picked. I prefer incremental and piecemeal reform. I prefer a system in which we can elect politicians to represent the governed and thwart corporate abuse. I prefer a United Nations that serves the interests of people around the globe rather than corporate profit. I prefer a vigorous and free debate in the public arena. I prefer a judiciary that is not a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate state. I prefer the freedom to express dissent without government monitoring of my communication and control of my movement. I prefer to have my basic civil liberties protected, but we do not live in such a system. The corporate state's response to climate change has been to pass a series of draconian laws and set up a vast security and surveillance apparatus that obliterates our privacy, allows us to be snatched off the streets by the military and held without due process in indefinite detention, and criminalizes dissent. The corporate state holds in its hands the legal and physical tools to shut us down. Its response to climate change is not to alter course, but to silence any who resist. Joe Sacco and I spent 2 years writing Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. We wrote the book out of the nation's most impoverished sacrifice zones, places such as Indian reservations, abandoned manufacturing centers, the coal fields of southern West Virginia, and the nation's produce fields. Corporate capitalism holds total, unchallenged power in these sacrifice zones. The politicians, the judges, the press, even the boards of education bow before the dictates of corporate power. And in these sacrifice zones, activists have learned something many Americans have yet to understand. Corporations are willing to poison Earth and all of its inhabitants for profit. There are no limits. The collapse of the ecosystem in sacrifice zone brings with it despair, joblessness, high cancer rates, the loss of hope, and increased state repression. Those trapped in these sacrifice zones often retreat into drugs and alcohol. The only way for many to blunt the pain, they believe they have no agency, and this misery and despair serve the ends of corporate power As the environment devolves, the planet becomes one vast sacrifice zone. So when I wrote the book as a warning, global warming is already cutting grain production by several percentage points, the report found, and that could grow much worse if emissions continue unchecked. Higher seas, devastating heat waves, torrential rain, and other climate extremes are also being felt around the world as a result of human emissions, draft report said. And those problems are likely to intensify unless the gases are brought under control. The world may already be nearing a temperature at which the loss of the vast ice sheet covering Greenland would become inevitable, the report said. The actual melting would then take centuries, but it would be unstoppable and could result in a sea level rise of 23 feet with additional increases from other sources like melting Antarctic ice, potentially flooding the world's major cities. We've known about the deleterious effects of carbon emissions for decades. The first IPCC report was published in 1990. Yet since the beginning of the Kyoto Protocol era in the 1980s, we have emitted as much carbon dioxide as was emitted in the prior 236 years. The rising carbon emissions and the extraction of tar sands, I think the industry has figured out how to transport tar sands without building the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. This delivery seems to sure. We'll continue. No matter how many police approved marches are held, play by the rules and we lose. Resistance will come from those willing to breach police barricades. Resistance will mean jail time and direct confrontation. Resistance will mean physically disrupting the corporate machinery. Resistance will mean severing ourselves from the dominant culture to build small, self-sustaining communities. This resistance will be effective only when we refuse to do what we are told. When we turn from a liberal agenda of reform to embrace a radical agenda of revolt.
Some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown at the end of the empire. We have received word of a teacher in New York State being fired for doubting publicly the public lie about what happened at Sandy Hook. They say he is mentally ill because he believes that. In the Soviet Union, they often took people away because they said things that didn't fit what everyone else was saying and thinking. Well, it's not that new here, because here in Mount Liberty, there was also a guy who got sent away for thinking things and writing things. His name was Charlie Johnson. We continue his story, and we find Charlie now inside the massive fortress exploring his living quarters. Charlie is in his room. He hears something. A radio?
I heard voices. Words crawled on hands and knees along the tile floor, mumbling in a drain pipe. The rumble of rocks falling from a tin roof. I stopped short, lest the words climb onto my shoes and up my pants leg like so many garrulous pipes. The words, the voice, excited, yet disinterested. There were snaps, grunts, and crackles of static, and a woman's voice, the voice of someone announcing a golf event. Hushed, reverent, yet dispassionate. Knowing there were other things in the world to worry about, somewhere the announcer might have warm coffee and food later on. I followed the words around the corner, past my room, to the next door. Sound came from inside. I stopped at the black doorway to the side out of sight. I sucked a deep breath and ducked at the sparks of gunfire shooting from the room, popping in the dark. I pressed my back to the wall, my head sideways, my hands flat to the wall to make myself a smaller target. First there was small arms fire, single, sporadic, slacker shots, followed by two machine guns first. There were orders shouted by a high-pitched voice, answered by someone else, then rebuked by another, like a Burger King crew fighting to hold it together during lunch hour rush. I heard crawling through brush and denim, sliding over hard dirt. A knee thudding against a rock, fierce breathing, a battle scene in War and Peace played out by the community theater group next door. Then the calming voice of the female announcer in the wing. From here, we cannot see the White Sox forces attempting to make their way up what we believe to be Blue Buck Hill. If you have one of the topographical maps available from our local station, just a moment. I repositioned myself to keep from getting a stiff neck. I heard a boom. It could have come from just outside the building. Maybe mortar shells landing in the big green lawn. I thought the noise might have been the radio exploding because all was quiet for a minute. I looked down the hall at the staff door, expecting a click or a buzz. Want to come in? A man's voice came from the cave door. I poked my head around the corner. Things are going bad. Bullets zapping at you from three different places. What you got to do is grab every available time for a breather and enjoy that moment. Then you move on. And you keep going that way by little bits, like storming a hill or getting through a weekend at the in-laws or the death of someone close. I saw the radio on the dresser, heard more shots. I poked my head inside the dark and then stepped into the open. The bullets passed right through me. I couldn't tell if the voice was from the room or the radio. It sounded like someone reading from a text. Please sit. The imperative voice came from the chair in the corner area. Take a load off. Stepped inside, found a metal folding chair by the wall that I hauled into the middle of the room. The shades were pulled and the curtains drawn. My eyes began to adjust. There was a tree lamp by the window and a single bed in the middle of the room and the chair in the corner along with the dresser. How come he gets a tree lamp, I thought. Take a moment. I saw the man in the chair in the corner. He was bald on top, with hair on the sides suggesting a clown, and a giant mustache. I smelled smoke. I saw a lit cigarette in his hand, dangerously close to the fabric. We sat listening to the radio, the announcer giving the play-by-play of what must have been a gun battle somewhere, maybe a World War II-era rebroadcast, a reenactment of Okinawa. A great thing to have, Hart, he said after several minutes. I suppose he could see me staring at him in the near dark. Where else could I live? Look. Hart. Courage. Caring. Love. He took a puff. Sacrifice. Here it comes, I figured. Cherry on the cigarette glowed bright as he brought it to his mouth. Not many willing. The tone was lucid, faint, smooth, an insurance sales voice or a high school principal in a mid-sized town. A principal who snapped, gone insane, drunk, stressed, kidnapped a rival principal, kept him tied in the home ec lab. Oh, brother. I slapped my hands on my knees in preparation to push off the departure. I ain't until you showed up. You are special, my friend. My hands remained on my knees. Counseling my legs. Not yet. That's why you're here, partner. I know. I am? I said. Why? How do you know? Who are you? Everyone knows. I bet they do. They do. Of course. You see, if you know you're being persecuted, well, you dropped a cigarette butt. I hope there was something down there besides the floor. Persecuted because you're right, then that's easy. But if they can also plant the seed into your head that you're wrong or crazy or demented, or that you're really a criminal and deserve what you got, well, that changes everything, don't it? It all becomes unbearable. Am I right? You walked over to snap off the radio, and I could see he was about my size, I suppose, wearing tan slacks, white tennis shoes, and white suspenders over a white t-shirt, clean for the time of day. He walked slowly back to his chair and sat. What's your name? I asked. John. John who? You or Charles Johnson, of course. How do you know that? John who? You just got here yesterday. Your niece brought you, and you don't know why you're here. Observation, you think. That's right, I said, pointing an excited finger at him. John pounded another cigarette from a red pack and started it with a blue and white light. Nobody knows why they're here, he said. He sucked, blew the smoke, and stared right through it. But everyone knows why you're here. You're special. But maybe everybody is wrong, huh? Who's everybody, I asked, quickly tiring of his game. Everybody in the resistance, of course. The resistance, I said. Some resistance. You're nuts. That's why you're here, isn't it? I was tired. He was pushing me too far for this time of night. I'm certain it shows my voice. Me. You. The White Sox. He pointed at the silent radio, ignoring my delicate mood. White Sox? The folks fighting the goddamn Red Sox out northeast of Branson. I thought to myself, you do not get locked inside this place for having high SAT scores. But why am I here? Why does he know so much about me? I decided to work it for information. If I was an inmate on double secret probation on Larrabee Unit, I must be capable of incredible sneakiness. I said nothing, tried to keep my countenance poker smooth. Then I held out my cupped hands. He flipped me the cigarette. When I'd shown I could catch, he tossed the lighter. We smoked, talked about he and me and the White Sox and the goddamn Red Sox. My head bobbed and my eyes closed. As the shade lightened and the picture of Beach Boy's Jesus on the wall came into focus, I thanked John for the cigarette and pushed my chair back against the wall. John stood to undo his suspenders. I walked toward my own room. As I stepped through my door, I heard him say, John who? John who? Damn Lennon, that's who.
That's the news from Mount Liberty. While the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another New American Dream radio show. We're here every Thursday streaming to you from freedomslips.com. Or you can also find us at newamericandream.info and see all of our archived shows. We thank you for joining us. We hope you'll be back again next week and every week. And I'd like to thank you, Mike, and good night.
I'd like to thank our guests, Sherwood Ross, Ole Domegard, and Mickey Z. And good night to my friends, Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And so, good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night,